Welcome to this ICIS Chemicals podcast, where we will be analysing the impact on chemicals of a packed news agenda this week. A global semiconductor shortage threatens automotive chemical markets. INEOS has delayed its propylene dehydrogenation plant at Antwerp. And Brexit and global logistics nightmare continues. And last but not least, new US President Joe Biden starts signing executive orders to reverse many of Donald Trump's policies. With me to discuss these topics, I'm delighted to welcome two of our regular commentators, John Richardson, who's our senior consultant in Asia, and Paul Hodges, who's chairman of New Normal Consulting. Gentlemen, let's start with President Biden. Within hours of being sworn in, he pledged that the US, the world's second largest carbon dioxide emitter, would rejoin the Paris Climate Change Agreement. He also blocked the Keystone XL oil pipeline project from Canada to the US and halted oil exploration in protected areas. He also promises to inoculate 100 million people in 100 days. So, John, if I can start with you first, what impact do you see the Biden administration having on chemical markets in the short or longer term?
Well, I think joining the Paris Accord is huge, because now you have the US, the European Union and China will be competing for the green economy. We've got the European New Green Deal. We've got China with its very pivotal fifth plenum meeting in November, setting an environmental blueprint for the next 15 years, where they're spending an absolute fortune on electric vehicles, decarbonizing their economy, aiming for net neutral emissions by 2060. And now the United States are joining in. So, you know, I see this is the year of carbon, when the year of carbon will be at the front of the mind of the chemical industry. And we're going to see carbon taxes, maybe not this year, but they will develop, or carbon trading systems globally. For the chemical industry, it will mean that you build a cracker in the US Gulf, and if you want to move polyethylene to China, you face a carbon tariff and or credits that you need to try and win. And combined with that is, of course, plastic recycling. That it's, you know, it's a two-front attack on the old business model. That you've got the fact that now companies will have to pay for what the economists call externalities, the cost of their environment, the impact on the environment of their operations, both in terms of carbon and the plastic waste they leave in the environment. So it's cleaning up the rivers in Indonesia, keeping plastic out of the ocean, and its new manufacturing processes, moving away from the standard steam cracker towards chemical recycle, mechanical recycling. And, you know, and chemical companies now are talking about making their refinery chemical sites carbon positive. So there'll be lots of, you know, we'll be moving towards new manufacturing processes, but within the existing conventional manufacturing sites, there'll be a lot of focus on how do we minimize the production of carbon. And now the US is on board. That's just so important. I suppose the final thing is if Biden get his huge, you know, stimulus programs through, lots of new jobs in the United States in green industries. So it's absolutely huge, Will, I think.
Paul, do you agree with John that it's going to really push the sustainability agenda and have a more of a sort of global approach to decarbonisation?
Yeah, I think we've turned a page here, and if effectively we turned the page a year ago, if you look with the pandemic, where people were at home more, they saw all these piles of waste plastic, and they said, "Why are we wasting all this money? Why are we wasting all this resource?" And so on. They had clean skies because people weren't driving anywhere. They could breathe the air. And they went, why don't we have this normally? Why are we doing this to ourselves? And Trump was a blocker. All Trump was doing was stopping things. You know, and he wasn't very competent, which is why the States has got such a very high death rate from COVID and so on. And now we've got somebody who is more competent, who is certainly much more interested in doing things. And crucially, what it means is we are back to the world of American leadership. And there's nobody else who can do this. Now, we may have all bitched 5 years ago about America this and America that and so on and so forth. Well, we're not going to bitch about it now. We need leadership in this world. And China, you know, China's doing, you know, some, Xi Jinping is doing some things right. Europe is doing a lot of things right. But they haven't got the global reach that the States does. And so this is terrifically important. And I think we're going to see, just as John says, a massive acceleration, because coincidentally, we've got the COP26 climate change conference in Glasgow, in Scotland, in November. And so everything is going to be focused on that. And Biden has put John Kerry, who's a very seasoned diplomat, in charge of that. And Kerry believes in this. So Kerry is going to go around the countries and he's going to do the deals and he's going to make this work. And so, you know, if we're sitting here in a year's time talking about what happened, the change between today and January next year will be immense. And we'll look back and we'll say, well, the actual moment where the change really accelerated was yesterday on the Capitol at the inauguration. Because, you know, you look at the way that Biden came in, he wasn't like Trump. Trump hadn't appointed half of his people by the summer. Trump has put out the list, Biden has put out the list of everybody he wants, all those 500 points, they're there waiting. You know, waiting now for nomination. And I think they'll go through the Senate very quickly. I'm not in the camp, by the way, of worrying about will the Republicans, you know, agree to this or will there be deadlocks? There won't be. The Tea Party element of the Republican Party will split. And the decent Republicans, Liz Cheney, for example, the third ranking Republican in the House, has already said, we shouldn't be dealing with people like this. Ted Cruz, you know, what is he doing in the Republican Party of Ronald Reagan? This is appalling. And yeah, I think the decent Republicans understand this.
In terms of chemical companies and the way that they produce, market and supply chemicals, what kind of changes do you expect to see, you know, in the next 12, 24 months as a result of this big push by Biden to the green agenda? Perhaps Paul and John, I can ask both of you that.
Yeah, I think... you know, we're going to see obviously the restriction of oil exploration in the United States. I think a lot of the environmental regulations will be reimposed, increasing the cost of oil and gas production in the States. That's certainly the short term. Obviously, the Keystone project won't be happening, so that's big. I think going back to what I was saying before, well, I think it, you know, now we have the US, you know, back on the on the track of global opinion, that we know that human activity is causing climate change. We know it's the biggest geopolitical, social, economic threat of our generation, of many generations. It's got to be dealt with. And, you know, this will mean we cannot make chemicals in the same way that we have been doing. We can't move chemicals around the world. Combined with the recycling issue, it will become a local for local industry. We need new manufacturing processes. You know, companies in every industrial sector have got away with this since the Industrial Revolution, Will, that they don't pay for the externalities, they don't pay for the cost that they're inflicting on the environment. It's a tax-free operation. And that's you know, the US now is moving back into the global consensus. And so, you know, it will be more taxes, more regulations. Huge opportunity for the chemical industry, for the innovators, for the people who can make old refineries carbon efficient, that can capture heat better, transfer heat better, they can reduce emissions using digitalization. And then we move towards new manufacturing processes. So that's a lot there, Will. But it's, you know, if you're in the C-suites, you got to get real and start planning for this.
Paul, what are the biggest changes that you expect to see?
Well, I'm going to focus on recycling, because I think this for chemical and plastics industry is critical. And one thing that I'm incredibly positive about was that just before Christmas, Susquehm, with support from CEFIC, the European Industry Group, Plastics Europe, the Plastics Industry Group in Europe, and the converters, produced this sustainable plastics strategy. And it is a very, very good document, because what it is a sort of 50-odd page roadmap of what we have to do. And so this is the industry doing what I love the industry to do, which is to take a lead, to understand the issues around it, and instead of being in denial and saying, oh, they don't understand, which is never going to get you anywhere to start with, but instead of this, you're saying, look, this is the way that we should be going. And so it's, they have set out a roadmap there, which is really, I think, a very exciting path on recycling. I want to come back to recycling, because essentially what we're going to be moving to now, as John says, is we're going to be looking at local to local. We don't have the great demand because, demographics for a second, we don't have large numbers of young babies being born. Well, all babies are young, of course. We don't have lots of babies being born. We don't have lots of young people anymore. We do have lots of older people, 55 plus, the perennials, and they don't need much stuff. And the younger people, they've already got most of the stuff that they want. Instead, what they, if they're going to want anything, they want experiences. So there's no future for us in supplying products. What we need to be doing instead is to be supplying services and solutions to people. And so recycling, working with the brand owners, and working with Unilevers, working with PureCycle. Now, for example, P&G have come up with a recycling polypropylene process, and there's $120 million being invested now in a pilot plant so that they can use recycled polypropylene in Pampers and everything else. So there is an opportunity and a threat. If the industry doesn't implement the Susquehm plan, then the brand owners will do it themselves, and we'll be cut out of the pie. There's always a carrot and a stick here. But what I'm absolutely sure of, going back to our previous conversation, is that within 3 months, the American chemical industry will have dropped all this nonsense about, oh, you don't understand, what we're doing is perfect. And they will be in the forefront of the push for recycling and in the forefront of the push for climate change. So I'm very, very positive that the giants of the petrochemical industry and the plastics industry will very soon all be going at full speed in what I regard as the right direction.
Great. Now let's look at INEOS's decision to postpone its PDH project at Antwerp. Now it says it wants to prioritise ethylene production from the other part of the project, the ethane cracker. But I wonder if the real reason's economics. Both projects are fed mainly by imported US ethane and propane, and with oil and therefore naphtha prices now structurally lower than they were when these projects were approved, I wonder if they still make sense from a production economics point of view. John, from a demand point of view, do you think polypropylene demand is going to hold up well enough to justify the PDH project in the longer term?
Yeah, well, demand is not the problem. We've had this pandemic-related demand that we've talked about before, the huge surge in packaging demand. Polypropylene goes into packaging, durable goods, personal protective equipment. I see more of it as how we supply it. And I would be questioning whether we need to build any new crackers, any PDH plants, regardless of the feedstock, because of the recycling agenda. So demand is not the issue, it's how we supply that demand.
Paul, do you think economics is driving this, or the fact that we're going to be seeing more and more recycled material in the future?
I think that we haven't had a new cracker in Europe since 1994, when BASF opened the Antwerp cracker. And but obviously, there's a lot of maintenance and replacement and so on. There's not much of those old crackers still left from day one. But we're in a good position in Europe, because it means that you can phase these crackers out over 10 years. And it won't really affect your bottom line. And in the meantime, you can replace it with local to local recycling, as John said, and you can work with your the collection systems, with the brand owners, to redesign the business model, because this is the key task that we've got now. How do we actually do distribution and collection of plastics in a carbon positive rather than carbon negative way? And a lot of effort is going into that. I differ a bit from John in that I think we've got to be very cautious indeed about what we think the level of underlying demand is today, because unfortunately what we're seeing is rapid spread of COVID around in many countries, particularly in the West, but also getting outbreaks in China and elsewhere. And there's an awful lot of precautionary buying going on, because a buyer, as we know, I've been a buyer, you know, a buyer can lose his bonus or her bonus because they paid too much for the product, but they can get sacked if they run out their plant. And so in these circumstances where you don't know whether your supplier will be able to operate next week, it makes sense to buy earlier and say, look, I'll just put it in the store. And that you go to the CFO and say, look, do you mind if I spend this money? She says, no, that's fine. You know, we've got zero interest rates. We've got a nice credit line at the bank, you know, if you're a large company. So go ahead and do it. So precautionary stock is there. How much of that is real stock? You know, how much are we actually using today? I don't think we know, but I suspect it's much less than we think. I think most of the value chains are stuffed full of product on the precautionary principle. And where I think Ineos, and I love Ineos. I like the people there. I've worked with a lot of them over the years, but they've made a mistake here. And polyethylene, 50% of polyethylene goes into single-use plastics. So why do you want to build a new cracker to make more ethylene and polyethylene in Europe? Europe is in the front line of this move to single-use. It's kind of assuming that the European Commission and the national governments and the brand owners have all got it wrong, which they might have done, and that they're all going to say, OK, we got it wrong, you're right. I mean, I wouldn't put a penny of my money into that. You know, I just don't think. And the issue, you know, you look at Shell, for example, saying we're going from 19 refineries last year to 6 in 2025. You know, you can see that the S curve is accelerating, and that transport is moving away from gasoline and diesel to electric vehicles. 1 in 4 of European car sales in December was an electric vehicle. 1 in 4. And I'm not talking about hybrids. I'm talking about a battery electric vehicle. 1 in 4. So that game has passed now. We know where this world is going. And so I don't understand why Ineos want to continue with this, because I can't see it ever having much demand.
So you think they should probably cancel the cracker as well as the PDH?
Well, I would cancel the cracker first. that would be me if I was in that boardroom. I would cancel the cracker. But you know, polypropylene, 25% is recycled. A lot of it goes into long durability applications in automotive and so on. I can get quite excited about the role of plastics in the electric vehicle market, because after all, batteries are going to be quite heavy, are quite heavy today, and therefore you need to lightweight the car in order to reduce the size of the battery that you need to go long distances and so on and so forth. So I can get quite excited about the role of plastics, and I can get quite excited about the role of polypropylene. I can't get excited, I'm afraid, about the role of polyethylene in single-use packaging.
Thanks, Paul. And finally, supply chain is another massive story this week. There's lots of different things going on. China's suffering another regional coronavirus lockdown, which could stifle supply from some parts of the China industry. The global container shortage is persisting, and rates are soaring to double or triple their long-term average. And then chemical prices are spiking in some value chains because of feedstock shortages dampening production. And at the same time, a global shortage of semiconductors is dampening auto production. That's our magazine cover story this week. John, what do you think the biggest risks to chemical supply chains are at the moment?
I'll let Paul talk about Brexit, because that's huge. But let me talk about China. If they don't bring the pandemic, the latest outbreak, under control, there's 23 million people in lockdown. There's no suggestion it's going to happen. It's happening yet. But if that was to spread to the manufacturing heartland of southern China, bang. We're so dependent on China for our imports. And we saw that last year. China's pivots away from stuff we don't need to stuff we do need. You know, they dominate the PPE market, the face masks, the hospital gowns, the stuff we need to convert our homes into offices, the tins of paint, the rolls of wallpaper that we're using under lockdown. And you know that the global supply chain would come to a grinding halt, as they did last March, if China can't control the pandemic. Another issue is electricity shortages, Will. It's the coldest winter in northern China since 1966. So what we have is, well, it started in December. It's a combination of really cold weather, lack of LNG infrastructure to store imported gas. So that's a long-term issue. But also the fact that in December, export growth was 18%. And December is normally a quiet month for exports. It's because the West is importing all this stuff from China for our pandemic lifestyles. So you have a combination of extremely cold weather, poor infrastructure, and this extraordinary export demand. So it really, for me, shows how unbalanced the world is and how dependent it is on China. And finally, on the freight rate issue, the reason why freight rates have gone through the roof is lots of demand. One of the main reasons is lots of demand for containers going to China. Lots of demand for containers leaving China, but not the same demand for containers going to China. So all these are a major threat. I mean, I think as well on the demand side, that the restrictions of the Lunar New Year holidays will mean a lot less people will be traveling back to the parents or the grandparents for the, you know, big family reunions. They'll be buying less gifts to take with them. So we won't see the demand spike that we normally get pre-Lunar New Year. And combine this, so that's going to slow chemicals demand down, I think, for a couple of months. But as I said, the real, really big threat is if this virus gets out of control in China.
Paul, Brexit paperwork's proving to be a nightmare, isn't it? With some haulage companies refusing to cross the channel. How much disruption to chemicals do you anticipate from Brexit, or would you like to highlight any other factors on supply chain?
Well, I think it's just all the things that we've been talking about here over the past year, which people on the Brexit side dismissed as Project Fear. The answer is it wasn't Project Fear. It was just, if you decide to go back to sort of really pre-1973, when the UK first joined the common market, and you're not in a customs union with your closest neighbours, and you're not in a single market. So the single market means you don't have automatic right to sell your products anywhere. It's got to be approved by somebody else. And not in a customs union means you've got to fill in paperwork in order to show what you're doing so that they can decide whether that's all right or not. If you go back to that, and it's a very long time ago, 1973, so nobody remembers how to do it. I certainly, I wasn't around then. So, it's chaos. And, I've seen the hauliers who are at the front line of this saying, one in 100 companies is getting their paperwork right. Because, as we've said here time and time again, the customs declaration form is 50 odd questions. And if you put your tick in the wrong box by mistake, the customs person isn't the friendly policeman who clips you around the ear and says, now go home, sonny, and don't do it again, otherwise I'll tell your mum. The customs official just says, no, you can't come in. And you have to do this on both sides. You've got to do a customs declaration for the UK authorities and for the EU authorities. I mean, nobody in their right mind would ever have done this. I mean, it's completely crazy. And of course, it's just causing massive backlog, and people tried to stockpile. This is why, if you look at the UK chemical output, it was extraordinary in, from September onwards to December, which, you know, if you didn't know any better, you would say, gosh, the economy must be firing on all cylinders. Well, anyone who was in the UK would know that was far from the truth. It was stockpiling. But as those stockpiles run out, and we're already seeing some industries, you know, if you're trying to export from Great Britain to Northern Ireland, chaos. Supermarket shelves are empty of certain products. You know, people like Sainsbury's have had to buy products from Spar to put on their shelves to cover because they can't get their own products across the Irish Sea. The Scottish fishing industry has collapsed. 300 million euros a year of salmon exports stopped overnight because of the veterinary links and so on. Because what people forget is, if you talk about, oh, there's no tariff barriers, that's not how countries control trade these days. They control them through non-tariff barriers. That's what they do, because they don't flag up so easily. And the British negotiators were so incompetent, they didn't understand, they didn't care. So I'm afraid the poor old chemical industry that I know and love, that I worked in for so long, is in the front line of this. And we will get through it, but it's an enormous amount of work for customer service teams. It's, you know, we're going to have to put in new teams of people to cope with customs paperwork. Well, what a complete and utter waste of time and money at this stage, that you now have to employ people to do paperwork for stuff that you were able to do with no paperwork 3 weeks ago. I mean, Ava, we are where we are. The Brexiteers won, the Remain lost, and you know, the UK pays the price.
Thank you very much, Paul, for your views, and also to John, and thank you for listening. It's very easy now to subscribe to ICIS Chemicals podcast. Just go to your podcast app and search for ICIS Chemical Podcast. It's as simple as that.